Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the March 20th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie. It is Friday, March 20th, and we're going to do a show this afternoon about corporate America, focusing on the IBM company, one of the icons of the American industrial scene, which has had a long and storied history, and which has undergone quite a cultural metamorphosis from its founding era. And I think it's useful to examine a company like IBM in order to get a better understanding of the trends that are affecting corporate America in general. And since I am fortunate to be able to have as a guest author Peter Grulich, who is a veteran IBM executive, had a many year career with that company, and then upon leaving IBM, branched into writing and publishing, and is the author of a book, A View from Beneath the Dancing Elephant, which is a history of IBM and sort of a critique of the changes in IBM's corporate culture. So, Pete, you are on the air. Hello.
Very good. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate you having me on the show so that everybody can kind of understand. I've been at IBM for 30 years, and I'm what is called a jack of all trades. I started out in administration, was a first-line manager, worked as a product manager, a worldwide marketing manager, worldwide sales enablement, and finished off my career in Tivoli, which was within the software group component of IBM. So it was a long career, and I'm very grateful for it. So very quickly, let me just kind of set as an example or for your audience a very quick overview, because I'm sure they're sitting there wondering, how can you do 100 years of IBM history in an hour to an hour and a half? So the first thing we're going to do is break IBM up into what I refer to as four eras, distinct time frames of distinct leadership. The first one would be the Watson Senior era, covering about four decades. The second one will be the Watson Junior era, covering about three decades. And in that, I include not only Watson Junior, but Vincent Learson and Frank Carey, two other CEOs that followed him. Another era that I refer to as the Opal Acres era, which anybody that's been with, you know, around IBM understands the 80s and 90s. It's well documented the problems they had then. And then I'll cover the what I call the Gerstner 21st century era, which covers the last two decades. So we'll talk about those as four unique eras. And then within each era, I will talk about three attributes: the cash, how these CEOs and the people of IBM handled the cash internally, the culture of IBM. You know, was it poor? Was it stable? Was it a rich culture? Referring, you know, specifically to the employee culture within IBM. And then finally, how did each of these, in these eras, were the stakeholders within IBM defined and handled? And Bob, when I talk about stakeholders, you know, you may have some opinions here. I talk about stakeholders as being four stakeholders within a company: customers that buy products, employees that invest their time, shareholders that invest their money, and then the society within the, which they belong. And it's really the balance of these, you know, how you reward these stakeholders as a CEO that determines, in my opinion, the long-term success of a corporation. So, Bob, does that make sense? Just kind of a high-level overview. Anything you should even poke at there that you think's unclear?
No, I think that works really well, and we'll kick it off with the kind of the beginnings of the Watson era from the 1914 to 1956. And for just a little background, IBM started out as an industrial company with very varied product line. It made all sorts of equipment. I think it was in scales and measurement devices and clocks and stuff like that. And then as industrial America began to have more information processing needs, the company moved into what was to turn into its bread and butter business, the punch card tabulator, which allowed companies to keep track of and amass much greater quantities of data than they could that they were able to do previously with just paper records. And this was all done under the leadership of Thomas Watson Sr. So I'm going to hand it off to Pete to go over what the company was like in those years and the kind of beginnings of a very unique corporate culture.
And Bob, that was a perfect introduction, because the way I normally summarize what you just said is that Watson Sr. took the company from meat slicers and candy scales that sat on his retail customers' front and back counters to the back office with tabulating machines and typewriters. To understand kind of the obstacles he also had to move from hand crank devices to electrical devices. So you can imagine handling inventory, moving from machines that were cranked by human power to electrical machines that were doing tabulating and typewriting. And you had to balance that with building just enough machines for the right target audiences where people had electricity to run them. So sometimes we don't have a good appreciation for how hard it was and difficult to make those kind of transitions from the front and back counter to the back office of his customers. So, yeah, absolutely a beautiful summary. So let's start off, like I said, this is the first area that we're going to cover. Let's talk about cash, culture, and then stakeholders. So when Watson Sr. took over what was then Computing, Tabulating, and Recording Company, the CTR, it was a predecessor. It had been founded by Charles Flint in 1911. Watson Sr. took over in 1914, and they were deep in debt. He was taking over in the middle of a recession that still had about a year to 18 months left to run its full course, and he couldn't get loans. The company was in deep trouble. The company, when it was initially founded, sold stock at a value of about $10 million. And it was worth about a third of that. It was down to $3 million. He immediately had to step in and say, okay, what do I do here? Two of the companies, the Phoenix Scale Company, the tabulating machine, weren't showing any profits, but the time recording machine gave him the revenue that he needed. And he went on to a lease rental basis to establish, I wouldn't say a cash rich, but a cash stable flow. So if you can imagine that you are renting or leasing out your hardware, that gives you a month-to-month revenue that you can count on, a year-to-year revenue that you can count on. But it's also hard to have a development or a investment organization where you have to invest a lot of cash because you don't get your investment back but over 5 to 10 years as you rent or lease those machines because you don't sell them. So this also helps understand even how more, how big of a decision it was for him to start research and development at IBM in 1915 and 1916, to make that kind of a cash investment in the company when he wouldn't recoup it, the investment for 3, 4, 5 years was a big gamble. And I don't think a lot of people realize the kind of gamble he took with the company at that point. In 1921, he almost drove the company into bankruptcy. He forecasted 1 year to have 100% growth. He had seen 3 to 4 years of tremendous growth, and he said in 1920 and 1921, we're going to double the business. Well, the recession of 1921 hit, and the net income fell to a third of what it was when he took over in 1914. And you know, Board was ready to pull him out, and he really resourced to, he had layoffs. I know a lot of IBMers like to say they didn't have layoffs, but if you go back and read it, most of the executives will say layoffs since the Depression. In 1921, Watson had layoffs, and he saw the effects of them, and he was determined to never have layoffs again. After seeing how it held back his company, he lost his research and development organization. He couldn't deliver products that he needed to, so that when the economy started to turn around in the roaring 20s, 22, 23, and 24, he wasn't ready to go. He had to staff that all up again. So understanding the cash position and how he handled that is important to understand, you know, when we get to the third era here when IBM had another cash crunch, and how, you know, if you can look back at history, you can see how Watson Sr. handled it, why he developed a distaste for laying off people that didn't deserve to be laid off. A lot of people think that IBM was a welfare system, and under Watson Sr. it was anything but that. It actually meets Jim Collins' definition of what I call a rigorous organization, where the people that are working there are the best, and you constantly are weeding out the weak or the ones that aren't performing and keeping the best. And that leads into culture. You know, how did Watson Sr. form this culture? When he took over, I would say it was a cash-poor company, didn't have money. You know, it was culture poor. He had three organizations. He had the computing scale company, the tabulating machine company, and a recording time company that didn't talk to each other, that didn't cross-sell. They had fist fights when they had joint meetings. So initially when they started, they kept all the meetings separate. And, you know, it was the culture was horrible. They were at each other's throats. So he came in and said, look, he came up with what he called maxims. One of them was democracy in business. He talked to his management and said, look, we are all assistants. We're not here to pound on people, to berate them. We're here to be their assistants. And then in the midst of the Depression, he came up with, we forgive thoughtful mistakes, you know, encouraging his employees to move forward. He is probably one of the most prolific writers and documented CEOs in the history of America. There are millions of words available on the internet and in books, so there's no way to misinterpret his intent and what he was going after. It's repetitive at times, but you can find, you know, his thoughts on democracy and business in his speeches, not only internally within IBM but to other businessmen. If I know Bobby said that you had read Father and Son, and one of the excerpts that Watson Jr. wrote about his dad was during this time frame. You know, how did he go about building this culture? And a lot of people think that, you know, IBM's always had a lot of money. And Watson Jr. said, you know, my father didn't have a lot of money. He held things together with baling wire and words. He promised his people, and then he delivered. And the story of how he delivered it, I think, is an amazing one, and it shows true service and a belief in a CEO and how you develop a culture. So the Depression hits, and he's been promising his people, you know, we're going to pay you more money. I've got this wonderful vision where I want to take you. And the Depression hits. He was faced, with a time when IBM didn't have the money that it needed, and he could have cut back on dividends. He did that in 1914 to put the customer first. We'll talk about that, to put the customer first. But at this point, he said, hey, we're going to put the shareholder first, and I can't pay you IBM employees what I want to, but here's why. He had found out that 2,200 of the 4,000 shareholders that he had in 1933 were women. IBM stock had become a women's and orphan stock, and he basically stood up in front of the IBM employees and said, I can't pay you what you deserve. But we've got a greater service to perform here. We need to keep women off the street and keep food in the mouths of children, so we're going to continue to pay dividends. And someday I will reward you and pay you for that. It was an amazing you know, statement by a CEO in full honesty standing in front of his organization and saying the facts. I think that's a lot of what we're lacking today, is that ability to communicate and pull people together around, you know, a belief in true service.
I mean,
and that's depression. Go ahead, Bob.
Contrast, you know, to what's been going on, I mean, in corporate America in the past 10 or 15 years, when the, you know, Watson Sr. did this balancing act where, you know, unbelievably he was able to avoid layoffs and the depression, and at the same time, you know, he held the line on compensation, and he balanced that with his responsibility to the shareholders, whereas, you know, today, I mean, this is such a contrast where a company is in trouble, it has no trouble laying off thousands of people, doesn't have too much trouble axing dividends either, but it's, and doesn't have any trouble in wildly increasing the compensation of its executives. So it's such a contrast to what was, you know, a little less than a century ago compared to now.
Oh, absolutely, and that's a great segue, because what happened, the Depression ended, and you can imagine Watson Sr. saying, hey, I can now start paying my employees what they deserve. He actually started to give them raises within the plants at Endicott, but then World War II hit. And he limited IBM's profits on all war munitions to 1.5%. He said, we are not going to profit off of World War II, and this is a time, again, of true service when we should be helping our country defeat fascism. He said, we are not going to make money off of this. So he basically limited all profits off of all munitions work that IBM would take on to 1.5%. He then earmarked that 1.5% for widows and orphans of IBM veterans, so that those IBMers that went to the war and you know, left a wife behind, he established a fund that would take care of the women and children, so that when the men or the women went off to war, they knew no matter what happened, their families would be taken care of. So, in essence, he said that we will make no profit off of munitions. And, you know, the amazing part of that is 75% of IBM factory space at that point was dedicated to munitions production. We're not talking about 5% or 10%. 75% of IBM production was limited to basically no profits. So he's sitting there, and he's saying, I told my people I'm going to give them something. And here's what he did. He had negotiated back in 1914 that his pay was a salary and a commission. And his commission was 5% of all profits, after $6 per dividend was paid. He went to the board and he said, look, let's cut my profits, you know, my commissions from 5%. And he initially went and said, cut them to 2.5. He went a second time and said, cut it to 0.5%. And let's put all that money into the Watson Retirement Fund. When I initially was doing my research on IBM, and I've never seen this written anywhere else or documented anywhere else, I saw a line item in the early, you know, in this time frame that said Watson Retirement Fund. Well, I was looking at it with a 21st century mindset going, oh, they're establishing a retirement fund for Watson Sr. Well, no, this was a employee Watson Retirement Fund. He funded, during World War II, and starting in 1945, he funded the IBM retirement plan that existed until July 1st of 1999. That defined benefit plan was a result of Watson Sr. cutting his commissions from 5% to 0.5%. Can you imagine the culture that formed, the dedication, you know, that employees felt, a man who, you know, lived up to his commitments and took the cut to deliver what he had promised to his employees?
Yeah, I mean, again, when you, it's like, you know, another universe compared to the attitude of senior executives today towards compensation. And just very, you know, it really is remarkable. But and I don't want to interrupt the storyline. I think just as an aside, remembering from the autobiography, I mean, Watson was not born with a, you know, silver spoon in his mouth. I mean, he really, you know, he was born, I think, in 1874, and he was not well-to-do.
That's right.
The hard way, and he had a lot of empathy throughout his career with the, you know, the working man and the plight of working families. And I just want, I'll make one more aside here, which is true of both Watsons. It's such a paradox because IBM was, you know, eventually achieved this reputation of being the, you know, the bluest of blue chips, you know, modern, progressive, all of, you know, the model of American business. But the Watsons, I mean, in today's ideological age, would be considered heretics because they were Democrats. Watson Sr. was a very avid supporter of Franklin Roosevelt, and Watson Jr. was very close to the Kennedys. And a lot of people who look at, you know, who look at IBM as saying that this is what modern capitalism was all about, and it's like the natural outcome of what capitalism is. Well, it really isn't. I mean, IBM was led towards that unique culture that it achieved. It didn't just happen from the interplay of impersonal market forces. So I'll let you continue.
No, people get tired of hearing me pump my gums all the time, so I'm, you know, it's nice to hear your perspective, Bob. We'll be hitting about 30 minutes when I finish up this next section, but the next three eras will actually move relatively quickly because we'll have set kind of the groundwork with IBM and its founding with Watson Sr. So folks, hang in there with us, and in about 5 minutes we'll be at 30 minutes, and we'll be done with the first era. And then the eras after this, we will have kind of set the tone for what cash culture and stakeholder mutualism means. So if you go back and look at Watson Sr., we talked about cash. It was a cash-poor company that he found. It was a culture-poor company. And what about stakeholders? And in 1956, when Tom Watson Sr. died, they published one of his favorite phrases in the Memorial magazine of Think Magazine. And it basically said, businesses exist as a service to man. I mean, capture that. Businesses exist as a service to man. And then he went on to define the man. Consumer man, a worker man, an investor man, and a community of man. And I find this, you know, something that would be so relevant today if we really looked at our own selves as holistically. Every day we're consumers. We're workers, even more today than ever. Every one of us are shareholders or investors, and we all belong to a community of man. And you really don't want businesses that focus on only rewarding one aspect of your life. You want businesses that respect you as a consumer and deal with you, as Watson Sr. would say, with the golden rule. Same thing with a worker, a shareholder, or, you know, how it treats your community. So he looked at a stakeholder, and he looked at it from a biological perspective as mutualistic. And what that means is mutualism is for different types of organisms, in this case, that have a way of working together and cooperating together to the benefit of all. And that's where he believed the business should be. Let's kind of step through it very quickly how he got there. In 1914, I told you that company was worth, initially founded at a stock worth $10 million, was down to $3 million. They were not happy shareholders. And Watson Sr. walked in and said, I'm stopping dividends. He had a riot on his hands. I mean, the board of directors, you know, said you have to be nuts. But Charles Flint backed him up. And the reason Watson Sr. did that was because he knew if consumers didn't buy products, they were going out of business. So he was focusing on that consumer man, developing the products that he needed. He went, one of his favorite stories was getting a loan to establish the R&D department within CTR at the time. He also stopped pumping and dumping of the stock. A couple of the guys on the board of directors, because they couldn't make their money off of dividends, said, hey, let's just pump and dump the stock, which, by the way, at the time was legal. There wasn't anything legally wrong with doing it. Sorry, Bob, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that was very typical of the time, pump and dump. And I'm
not sure
that it hasn't come back either.
That's right. Well, it was legal, right? I mean, but Watson opposed it on ethical standards. And there you find another contrast, you know, of things that could launch us into another long debate of, you know, doing what's legal versus what's ethical, which will come up later as we talk about other the later eras of IBM. But he made the share, you know, he stopped dividends. He said shareholders are going to have to hold off. But then as I covered in the Depression, he put the shareholders first because there was a reason, and he communicated that reason. We've become a woman's and orphan's stock. We have to pay our dividends or people are going to be on the streets. He was constantly working on that mutualistic stakeholder environment, the consumer, the worker, the investor, and the society. And he talked to all four of those. There's an instance later as I where he went in 1948, and IBM was really starting to take off, and the shareholders were asking him, why are you keeping giving employees benefits? He went and he shook the hands of almost 20% of the IBM U.S. population 3 weeks before going to the shareholder meeting. And when he stood up in front of the shareholders, he said, you know, I can lay out all the inventory we have and the benefits of it, but our human assets we will continue to invest in. And that was his perspective, is every year he would look at the profits and he'd make a decision on how do I establish a mutualistic environment between the consumer, our customers, my employees, my shareholders, and society so that everybody benefits from this environment. So if you look at that and you look at what Watson Sr., he took over a cash poor, a culture poor organization. He took over at a time when corporations were actually new and they didn't even know what a share, you know, they knew what a shareholder was, but they didn't know what a stakeholder was. They barely knew what a customer was. And when he left or died in 1956, he left the company what I would call a cash stable organization. It was almost 100% rent and lease. You knew where your money was coming from, but it was still hard to invest. Right? I mean, you had, if you today, if you invest, you sell something, you know, the next day, and you get your money back. You didn't do that with a rent and lease environment. He established a culture that was known for paying benefits, for honoring the employee, for individuality. You know, think was the individualistic word, and stakeholder mutualism. The result is that over 42 years, four decades, he delivered 16.69% compounded annual growth. I got to say that, 17% compounded annual growth every year for 42 years. Bob, that's my summary. You know, so cash culture and stakeholder mutualism, and the result was that the shareholders came out ahead in the long run, the employees came out ahead, the workers, the customers came to know IBM as service and support, and society, they wanted IBM in your community. And this is, you know, the start of IBM in its first four decades.
Okay. Well, we'll now move on to the Watson Jr. years, and I'll just preface this with just a few remarks. The Watson Jr. years were from 1956, when Tom Watson Jr., who is Tom Watson Sr.'s son, took over the company upon the death of his father. Tom Watson Jr., very fascinating person in his own right, had colossal battles with his father as Tom Watson Jr. ascended the ranks of the company. The biggest one probably was the move into computers, which basically the move to computers. Tom Watson Jr. sensed the rise of computers as an alternate technology, one that would eventually replace the entire industrial base of IBM, which was the punch card machine, because computers were so much faster and more efficient. But the computers had enormous research and development expenses, and to manufacture them required an enormous amount of capital investment. And he had battles royal with his father about how fast do we expand, how much do we invest, how big do we grow, how many risks do we take. He kind of moved the company along, and he also had battles with his father about some of the cultural traditions of IBM, which had developed in the 20s and 30s and the World War II years. They would not work in the 1950s as America moved into industrial superpower status. One thing about Watson Jr., which is remarkable, is he kept some of those core principles: the no layoffs, expanded employee benefits, enlightened corporate governance. And then the overall thing that you have to understand about this era is the move into the System 360 project, which was one of the most ambitious gambles that any company ever did. When IBM pioneered the modern mainframe computer after experimenting with less, you know, capable machines in the 50s and the 60s, it took it to the next level. And now, Pete, I'll turn it over to you.
Perfect, and that's a great segue. And a lot of times I spend so much talking about Watson Sr. with folks that they go, you know, what about Watson Jr.? So let me state this as adamantly as I can. Watson Jr. could not have taken over CTR and made it the success his father did. Neither could Watson Sr. have taken the company in 1956 where Watson Jr. took over and take it where Watson Jr. did. It was two very unique men with two very unique management and leadership styles that when put together resulted in IBM of the 20th century. The amazing brilliance, I think, of Watson Jr. is that he took this tremendous amount of allegiance, loyalty, and dedication that was directed by IBMers to Watson Sr., and he didn't pass it off to himself and say, hey, you know, worship me. He said, I want you to have that allegiance and loyalty to the corporation. And I want you to think of IBM, and I want to think of yourself as IBMers, and I want you to see things as coming to you through an IBM corporation, not from my old man and not from me. So what he did is he established a constitution. And that constitution is the theme of my book, Bob. It's the, you know, rediscovering a view from beneath the dancing elephant, rediscovering IBM's corporate constitution. And that constitution, it doesn't matter what it is, it's that it's real. And at IBM, it was wrapped up in three words: respect, service, and excellence. And I can tell you that 100% of IBMers knew respect, and 80% of them probably knew service and excellence. It was respect to the individual, service to the customer, and the pursuit of excellence. And this was a constitution that even Tom Watson Jr. held himself accountable to. And when you start to look at imagine a son taking over from his father who was very centralized, controlled decisions, and suddenly saying, look, we need to decentralize. We need to allow our people, we've been telling them to think now for four decades. Let's let them do that. Let's let them get out and engage. Let's give them control of products. Let's let them modify the products that their customers need and make the decisions in front of the customer. So we established what I call a corporate constitution: respect for the individual, service to the customer, and the pursuit of excellence. And this established an authority outside of an individual. It was no longer Watson Sr. saying this is what's right or wrong, or Watson Jr. Everybody started to think about, is that respectful? Is that providing the best customer service? Are we on pursuing excellence? And that became the mantra of what we call wild ducks within IBM. the people that took on the system and forced it to do the right thing were backed up by the pursuit of excellence. So this culture that had formed under Watson Sr. could have died the day Watson Sr. died. But Watson Jr., within months of, you know, his father's death, held what he called a constitutional convention in Williamsburg and said, we're going to decentralize. We're going to empower people to make decisions. I think Bobby even says in his book, I couldn't work as hard as my dad did. I mean, he didn't want to live and breathe for the company every minute and every second of the day. He wanted to decentralize. The result? IBM grew by 20% over the next 5 years because he had decentralized decision-making. They started shipping new products, and the culture really became the culture of what I found in 1980. So that's the culture piece of it. What about cash? You know, everybody loves to talk about today, like IBM has all this cash, and it's always had this cash and had these benefits, and it never had hard times. Under Watson Jr., it faced one of its most critical moments in its history, just like 1921 with his father. Remember that most of IBM's hardware now was put on rent and lease. He had to make a decision, where am I going with this company? And the System 360 was built. Watson Jr. invested 10 times IBM's net income in 1960. IBM's net income, their profit, was $500 million in 1964-63 timeframe. Watson Sr. spent 10 times that amount on the System 360, $5 billion. That is a gamble. When you take and say, I'm only bringing in a dollar and I'm going to go invest five, that's a gamble. And that's what Watson Sr. did. And he documents in his book, Bob, the father and son, how he came with 2 weeks of missing payroll. They were ready to get to go out and take out an emergency loan. And instead, they went to their shareholders and said, we need money. And the shareholders bought the stock. And to me, that shows, you know, once again, in this era of Watson Jr., that mutualistic environment where Watson Sr. and Watson Jr. both talked to their shareholders, explained to their shareholders what was going on, and because they had their trust and confidence, they didn't need to go for a loan. They could actually sell stock to fund the System 360 and the effort. The result at the end of the Watson Jr. era, you know, 15 years, a decade and a half, when the company, you know, left the Watson Jr. era, it was cash rich. It was the workforce that IBM would be known for, you know, the 20th century, motivated, dedicated, committed. The shareholders were happy because Watson Jr. had outdone his father. Over his 15 years in service, he delivered almost 21% compound annual growth rate to the shareholders. And once again, it was a mutualistic environment where employees, customers, shareholders, and society all benefited. And when you have that kind of environment, that's when you can start to see long-term benefits. So, Bob, that's the end of era one and two, and I'm ready to go to three and four. That second era only took about 10 minutes. Do you have any comments there or set up for the next one?
Yeah, what I think we'll do is kind of pause for a little perspective. I think it's the Watson Jr. era where, I guess, how would you put it? The kind of soul of corporate America got defined because many companies imitated IBM in their own way. I mean, obviously, every company is different, every industry is different, but the things that IBM developed as a kind of this method, this tradition of balancing shareholders and executives and employees and society at large, that was replicated throughout corporate America in this great emerging consensus that happened after World War II about how does, you know, you want capitalism, you want the innovation that it can provide, you want the increased wealth that it can provide, but how do you make it responsible and responsive to what people in a democracy wanted? And to me, the
kind of the IBM legacy and the way it was duplicated by so many other companies, including the one that I worked for 34 years in the airline industry, American Airlines. They all of the big companies kind of more or less adopted the same attitude that the Watsons had. Of course, they had to modify it to the unique situation of their own industries and companies. Now, we're going to take a break in the next few minutes.
I can give you one quote. I was actually at SMU University doing some research on the relationship between Watson Sr. and JCPenney, and I can give you a great quote to end this section on from JCPenney, founder of JCPenney. He was under attack for being too wealthy of a Democrat. And somebody asked him, how much money can a Democrat have and still be a Democrat? And JCPenney's response to that was, a Democrat can have as much money as he can possibly have until the money owns him. And I didn't say it as poetically as he did, but, you know, it's that concept that when you lose your humanity and the money starts to control you rather than you control the money, that's when you start to see the problems at the root of capitalism, is my opinion.
Yeah, and I think part of the situation that we have, one of the reasons why politics is so divisive today, is that the post-war consensus about how capitalism should operate has been breaking down for the past 30 years. So instead of this balancing of interests that goes on, the mutualism that you describe, things have degenerated where one side or another, sometimes it's labor, sometimes it's capital, sometimes more often than anything it's Wall Street, is just out for what they can get, period, end of subject. And over time, the relationship between corporate America and the public that it's supposed to serve has been fraying. And I think that's the background between that's driving so much of the political divisiveness that we have seen in the past 20 or 30 years. But we are going to take a break, and then when we come back, I'll briefly introduce my brother, who's on the phone. I think he's still on the call. He worked in the computer industry as a systems analyst and programmer. And we're into nepotism on this show.
Way to go, Bob.
we don't have any qualms about nepotism. And when he began to work in the information technology business in the 70s, he obviously probably came across IBM, as did most people in IT at the time. And then he subsequently went on to do more and more in the music production business.
Perfect.
But I'm going to play a couple of clips, which I think both illustrate the duality of corporate life these days. One was suggested by Pete, which is a country western song about what happens when companies with the layoff and restructuring mania that has gone on close up shop and, you know, devastate whole communities. And then the other is a kind of a humorous clip from the Frasier show about what it's like to be hunting for a job in an era of restructurings and downsizing and all of that. So we'll play clips and we'll be back.
Everything to know about me is written on this page. The number you can reach me, my social and my age. Yes, I served in the Army. It's where I learned to shoot. 18 months in the desert, pouring sand out of my boots. No, I've never been convicted of a crime. I could start this job at any time. I got a strong back, steel toes, rarely call in sick. A good truck, but I don't know. I catch on real quick. I work weekends if I have to. Nights and holidays, give you 40 and then some. Whatever it takes, $4 and change at the pump. Cost of living's high going up.
Okay, and the next clip is from Frasier. This is a kind of a funny segment of Frasier. It has to do with his relations with his agent when he was in desperate career straits and negotiating on how to keep his job.
Oh. Oh, dear, don't turn around. It's that dreadful woman who works for you. Who? Lady Macbeth without the sincerity.
Oh, Vivi's here. Oh. Now, listen, Miles. I care for her just as little as you do, but she is a terrific agent, which is why I overlook the fact that she's pushy and obnoxious and the most appalling phony I've ever known. Vivi, darling, how are you?
My poor, wounded baby. I just heard what those misers you work for are trying to do to you. Well, don't you worry. They're not going to get away with it.
Well, you must have heard wrong, David. They extended my contract for another year with an 8% raise.
8%? Well, that would insult even a waiter. Double cappuccino. Move it!
Well, baby, that is what my contract calls for.
A slave contract you negotiated 2 years ago before you even had an agent. They took advantage of your inexperience.
I thought it was a very generous offer.
Oh, please, do you have any idea how hot you are? I get offers every day from other stations offering the moon for you.
Good Lord, am I really that hot?
Are you kidding? If I were a pot roast, I'd be done.
Hello, I'm Niles, a person at the table.
Niles, thank God you're here. Back me up. Give him some sound brotherly advice.
She's the devil, Frasier. Run fast, run far.
And then after preliminary negotiations, and Frasier finds himself on the verge of losing a job unless his final negotiations are successful. So here's the second clip related to that episode.
Why are you so tense? This is the best part. What could be more fun than this?
Watching a loved one be autopsied.
Think of them sweating in their offices, chain smoking, biting their nails, their ulcers churning out enough acid to burn a hole in a ship's hull. Oh, God. And to think I nearly went into nursing.
Oh, you're right, Peavy, you're right. Oh, God, they're foolish enough to let me go. Well, then, fine. There are any number of other stations that would love to have Frasier Crane on board.
Exactly.
Yes. But, you know, in fact, I think it's time maybe we discussed those other offers. Consider what our fallback position should be.
Ooh, someone's out of scotch.
Peavy, tell me there are other offers.
Scared!
Now, you look me in the eye and tell me the truth.
There are no other offers. Straight up or on the rocks.
Go.
Darling, you can't make a deal without bluffing a little.
You're supposed to bluff them, not me. My God, woman, are you trying to ruin me?
You are such a worrywart.
Now, don't you patronize me, you sweet-talking succubus. You get on the phone and call them.
Oh, my God, hands of Hercules. What must your legs be like?
Answer it.
Not yet. Where are we? Have we gone out?
Is it too late?
Answer it!
Crane residence. B.B. Glazer speaking. It's them. I see. I see. Fine.
Well?
Renegotiations tomorrow, starting from scratch.
Oh, oh, thank God. Oh, 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 my God. I'm so pleased. Thank you, B.B.
Maybe next time you'll trust little B.B.
Yes, oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay, well, those clips illustrate the transition to a different era, one from lifetime careers and commitments to one of a lot of chronic instability in the employment market. There is a sad sign, a sad side to it, exemplified by the song. And there's a funny side, or at least a bittersweet funny side, exemplified by the Frasier clips. I'm going to put my brother on the line. Like I said, my brother Phil worked in the computer industry for a number of years in IT. I'll just say hello to him. Hey, Phil, how are you?
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Good, good. Did you ever work with IBM equipment? In your career?
I learned on IBM.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, 360 and then the 370.
Uh-huh.
And when I started out working at RCA, RCA was making the transition from their Series 500 computers to their Spectre 70 series. And at that time, it appeared that IBM and RCA were going to go toe-to-toe for dominance in the mainframe market, because the 370 series the Spectre 70 series was basically a clone of the IBM 360, 370 series.
Interesting. And then did RCA stay in mainframe computers, or did they move out of?
No, I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, RCA got out of that mainframe business. I don't know if they could compete with IBM or what happened, but the Spectre 70 was a great machine. You know, it was the exact clone of the 360, 370 series. And when we were at RCA, all the computer, well, RCA Globecom, all the computers at RCA Globecom was installing at that time were the Spectre 70 computers. And we started programming, doing the changeover and programming their communication systems. That's when we started doing all the communication systems for banks and airlines, and it was basically the beginning of the internet. You know, a lot of the protocols that we were developing and writing at that time, eventually, years later, you know, were used for the beginning of the internet.
Well, that's a good segue into the rest of our discussion, because we're now entering the era where IBM's starting to face more and more competitive challenges.
Well, you know what happened at that time too. These mainframes were, a lot of money. You know, tremendous amount of money for these mainframe computers. Not only that, the infrastructure to support the mainframes was enormous. You're talking about, you know, the raised computer flooring, cabling all underneath the flooring, heavy air conditioning, heavy power requirements. And just about, I'm trying to remember what year, maybe 72 or 73, RCA Globecom was, we were doing another system, and that's when they made their transition away from the mainframe computers. And the new system that we started putting in was this was a company called General Automation. And these were the first, I guess you could say, the mini computers.
Yeah.
You know, that
okay, well, let's, just watching the clock here, I need to move into the next two phases of IBM's history before our guest time runs out. But again, like I said, it's a good segue because IBM was so dominant in the 60s, then it attracted competition. The government launched an antitrust suit against them in 1969. And then as the 70s and then especially the 80s unfolded, IBM began to lose the dominance in the industry. And then, of course, there were all these technological changes happening. IBM basically legitimized and then disposed of the personal computer business. It also moved away from leasing, which introduced a lot of volatility into its earnings. So, Pete, let's go on to the next phase in the history of the company, the Opal Acres years, 1981-1993, and have your thoughts about that.
Perfect. You can hear me okay, Bob?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. I was on mute for a while when you were playing Frasier, or else you would have heard me laughing on the floor. thanks for Phil chiming in. There's a great book out there that if your readers, you know, or your listeners, it's an older book, but it's by Robert Sobel. It's called IBM Colossus in Transition. And unlike me, where I'm focusing purely on IBM today, he actually looked at the whole industry. And, you know, that it describes exactly what Phil was talking about. You know, the battle between what at the time was called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, IBM being Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs being, the companies that were trying to compete with IBM. So excellent book, you know, to see, you know, the depth of the competition. I appreciate Phil's perspective, and nepotism is always appreciated. So we're going to move to the next era, which covers 1981 to 1993. I hired into IBM in 1980. I think I came up with the name for this era. I was calling it Opal Acres, but it's John Opal and John Acres. So I think I'm going to start calling it the John era because the two of them working together really put a double hit on IBM. When John Opal came in, IBM was cash rich. It was culture rich, and it had shareholder mutualism, you know, through 8 decades of Watson senior and junior leadership. So let's start off first with the cash, you know, how you go from a cash rich to a cash poor company. The first thing is that IBM at the time had been, you know, basically 80% of its install base was rental and lease. And I document this in my book, have the graphs to show it. You can debate whether the move from rental lease to purchase was required or not. There can be discussions on both sides. Third parties were coming in and starting to buy IBM hardware and compete with the rental lease base. You had antitrust suits going on. But the real problem was that the executive leadership, John Opal at the time, sold the rent and lease base off at pennies on the dollar. I was an administrator during this time, and our sales reps would come into the office going, you know, this is just a no-brainer. All I have to do is put the contract in front of them and show them the ROI. And we're talking about an 18-month, you know, return, or in 18 months they break even. We were basically having a fire sale to spike the purchase price or to spike revenue. And the CEO at the time, John Opal, set the expectation that and you have to listen very close to these numbers, that IBM would be a $100 billion corporation by 1990 and would be a $180 billion corporation by 1994. I think this was in Business Week, and the person that wrote the article, the reporter, kind of used the word hubris, and it really was, because IBM was not just anticipating to make those. It was investing in plants and hardware, and you know, it was just way ahead of itself and had goals set ahead. I've talked to product managers during this time, and they were just in meetings that you know they couldn't believe. And in essence, they took a revenue stream that was stable, flowed every year, you could count on it, and whether you can debate and there's reasons to go to a purchase during the time, a purchase-based technology obsolescence, and you don't want to be hanging on to those and getting rid of them. So there's a lot of reasons why you would look at a purchase. The real problem was is that the board of directors and the CEO of the time basically started to look at shareholder-only kind of rewards. You know, how do we, you know, spike the stock price and we'll promise the moon? And IBM has such a reputation built up over the last 6 to 7 decades that everybody will believe us. But IBM had faced cash-poor situations before, right? We went through the one with Watson Sr. in 1921 and it survived. It went through another one in the 1960s when it came within weeks when it bet the business on the mainframe, and it survived. And it basically, you know, Watson Sr. held it together with gum and spit, and Watson Jr. it held together because of Watson Sr.'s culture and the culture that he had built around dedication to a corporation. John Akers took over, and he walked into a mess. And in 1985, his first year, and he had started he tried to keep the old IBM paradigm of not laying people off or resourcing them, offering incentives to leave. Unfortunately, he offered incentives for our best people to leave. There were the people that, you know, had built the mainframe, the people that had, you know, the best systems engineers that we had out in the field in front of our customers, left IBM to go work for our customers, and you basically stripped the cream of the crop of IBM off and you sent them out to compete with us at business partners and in other corporations or to work for our customers. And the blow that John Akers, I can see what he had to do. He inherited from John Opel, you know, a corporation and expectations that were just impossible to meet. So he had to cut back financially. But what he did is he just took the winds out of our culture. We started a press came out, you know, IBMers are standing around water coolers. And I can tell you that, you know, the feet on the street were not standing around water coolers. And when people ask me, you know, how do you know that? Well, I was there. And the other piece of it is our payroll dependent on IBM, our pension plan dependent on IBM, and we all own stock in IBM. So if IBM had gone bankrupt, we would have lost our paycheck, we would have lost our pension, and we would have lost our employee stock. I mean, this is before Enron. This is before people developed common sense about not owning stock in the company you're working for. And it's before 401ks. We had everything on the table to lose, and we did not want to lose it. We just needed a leadership to take over that understood what we were going to do or that we needed to succeed. And then the final straw was shareholders started saying, hey, break up IBM into baby blues. You know, it's more valuable if you have separate little entities, if you have a separate disk organization, a separate printer organization. And we can make more money off of it if you break all that up, and then we can, you know, buy the stock of the ones that take off. And to me, this was the beginning of a shareholder-first type of mentality, where you start making decisions based on not what's good for the business, but what's good for the shareholders. And sometimes they aren't. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, let me interject here just for a second, because I just want to highlight that, put a magnifying glass on it, because one of the themes that I want to develop in my later shows, especially to my listeners who tend to be center-right conservatives, is this theme: Wall Street is not your friend. So in the context of this discussion about shareholders, I want to clarify that a little bit, because
character.
It wasn't mom and pop, you know, in Duluth, Minnesota, driving these changes in a company like IBM. It was the analysts and, you know, hedge fund. Well, maybe hedge funds not until a little later. But that type of mentality, the buccaneers of Wall Street who are always thinking of new ways to, you know, re-engineer companies to maximize their current sales value and stock price. And in my view, that is inimical to the welfare of the long-term interest of the company, of companies, and of corporate America itself in general, and the American public. All of these financial engineering games that go on, which started to occur in the 80s when the old line corporate leadership became more and more beholden to Wall Street in the way they ran their companies. So now I'll turn it back to you.
And Bob, I think there's a lot to be said in that, because you go back to Watson Senior's philosophy of, you know, every individual is a consumer, they are a worker, they are even today more than ever an investor, and we're a community of man. And we have to have CEOs and board of directors that have backbone and turn down reward systems that make them so focused on shareholder first, and we'll talk in a minute on shareholder only, that they lose sight of what's good for the business. If you go back again, I'll go back to Watson Sr. He got paid 5% of all profits after he paid $6 per share dividend. Well, if he had been so focused on just the reward, and I go back to the penny quote I gave you, where the money came to own him rather than him owning the money, he could have just driven dividends through the roof for 10 years and retired and gone and had a good life. But his goal was to build a business, as he said, that would last forever. And that's the difference, I think. You know, it's that what's good for the business is having all four of these shareholders in a mutualistic environment where it's not us and them. It's not shareholder pointing a finger at a customer and saying, or a customer pointing a finger today, hey, you're getting 80% profits and where's my products, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense, Bob? Okay,
yeah.
Good. Okay, so good. So John Akers, you know, the John era, when it came out of it, it was cash poor. Our culture was still there. It was, I'd call it stable, but it was disillusioned. We had poor leadership, and really all the stakeholders were upset, right? I mean, shareholders were upset. Stock was, you know, was down to, I think, 20s or 30s. Employees were worried about their jobs. We're going to be baby blues. Customers weren't getting product out. We weren't getting product out the door. And a new era started, and that started with Lou Gerstner. And, you know, the first thing I want to say is that, you know, Gerstner did financially save the company. I'm an employee owner. I have definite feelings about Louis V. Gerstner. But when he came over, when he took over the company, he hit the right tone, and he went after our culture first. And I sometimes think that the best way to put it is that there was a culture out there that was waiting for the right words to be said, and he hit the right words. He said, we are one IBM. We are not going to split up. We're going to stop this talk of baby blues. Our customers want an IBM. They want a solution. He stepped in and said, financially, we have to do something. We need to take over and get these we need to get the balance sheet. Cultural means nothing if financially you don't turn a profit at the end of the day in a capitalistic system. Right? You could have the greatest culture in the world, but if you aren't generating profits, customers don't get products, employees don't get raises, et cetera. And then finally, he came up with customer first. This wasn't a new concept. This had been IBM. I mean, this has been, that was our culture starting in 1914, going back to Watson. He was doing nothing more than repeating words that were so familiar to our ears that culturally we took off again. And what I would say, you know, to people that think that Gerstner did it all, is that 46% fewer employees delivered almost 80% more revenue for IBM. You cannot accomplish that without people putting their backs to the wheel. And that's what we did as employee owners. We had not given up. We were just waiting for the right words to be said. We were ready for John Akers to leave. And when Lou Gerstner stepped in, one IBM, customer first, we're going to do what it takes financially to turn it around. 40% fewer employees, generated 80% more revenue growth over the next 6 years. That was the IBM culture firing on all wheels. And then Lou Gerstner, in his book, wrote that respect for the individual had become bastardized. And he was never truly in touch with the culture. He became, his first 6 years culturally, he was firing on all cylinders. He was saying the right things. And then in July of 1999, I call it his watershed event in my book, he went after our pension plan. And I personally, a lot of people think I'm an old fart and I want that pension plan. I think that the 401ks, you know, are the direction that businesses needed to go. And but the way that Lou Gerstner handled it, and I document this well in my book, July of 1999, every IBMer in the United States of America and Canada now knew that we were just an employee and that shareholders were coming first. Because the bottom line is IBM took the money that Watson Sr. had sacrificed for to start the retirement plan, and basically 50% of IBMers lost anywhere from 40 to 50% of their retirement in one strike of the pen. This started a whole series of lawsuits. He started resource actions that never centralized decision-making and took it the ability for first-line managers that Watson Jr. had put in to make decisions in front of the customer, centralized that so they were no longer powerful, and the culture deteriorated. That became exacerbated with Palmisano. I document in my book the resource actions that have continued to happen almost quarter by quarter. Rometty has continued to tap into, you know, this theme of almost attacking the employees when she changed the 401k plan. It used to be that in most companies today, you invest in your 401k as you go along. IBM said now in December, you don't get your 401k match unless you're working for the company on the last day of the year of that year. So if you resource throughout the year, you lose your corporate match. And all these are just signals of a new approach, and it's affecting the culture, but it also has to do with the shareholder. It moved from a shareholder first to a shareholder only mentality, and that's where everything that moves that's financially can be done is moved to the shareholder value. IBM has spent $158 billion gross on share buybacks. That, interestingly enough, is about 10 times its net earnings in 2013. It's almost equivalent to the same amount of money of net income as IBM spent on the mainframe. So rather than investing in people, products, and processes, they've invested in paper. And that $158 billion. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I want to interject there a little bit, because this is actually, when you look at contemporary discussions, and I'm thinking about Seeking Alpha here, plus published stuff about IBM, under Palmisano, they had this announced goal of increasing earnings per share. I think the target was $20 earnings per share. They called it the roadmap. And they constantly harped that IBM was on the path to was keeping to the roadmap of getting to that $20 figure all throughout the Palmisano era. And one of the ways that you get to that roadmap, it is a calculation, earnings per share. So if you decrease the number of your shares, well, obviously your EPS is going to go up. And these massive stock buybacks are applauded on Wall Street and yet are also attracting a lot of critiques in the analyst community because they're saying, you know, you're not growing your business. Your revenues are actually declining. But when you look at EPS alone, it's a very rosy picture. And IBM committed its free cash flow to these buybacks, and it also started to take on debt to finance the buybacks. And it seems to have gotten to a fork in the road under Rometty where they said, you know, we're going to, number one, we're not going to meet the roadmap. We're abandoning it for now. We're not going to get there. We can't get there. And we're going to scale back the buybacks. So a lot of commentary in the stock market now about IBM is, okay, if they stop the buybacks and you don't have this automatic mechanism that gooses earnings per share, what happens to the company over the long run? Can it compensate for that by actually growing its business? And that's the big question mark. And I'll talk
about
you.
Yeah, and Bob, I think I get asked that question a lot, you know, about, you know, where else could they have put their $158 billion? And everybody talks about the cloud. And they say, well, did IBM miss the cloud? And if you look at what the cloud today is the manifestation of the mainframe environment. It is where IBM was in 1964. And if they had invested that $158 billion in centralizing and growing its processing power capability, in centralizing and controlling, you know, the security of a mainframe environment, of centralizing and controlling data, and the analytics, Watson, and the networking, if they had been investing in that through the Palmisano era, they would be ready to blow the cloud environment out of the water. They would be ready for the new generation of computing rather than playing catch-up. And that's when I keep talking about, you know, investing in paper rather than people, processes, and products. The whole cloud environment today is nothing more than a manifestation of IBM's strengths of 20 years ago. Centralization of processing power, centralization of security, centralization of data and analytics, centralization of networking. I mean, they should, it's everything coming back to IBM's core strengths, and because they got off track, they failed to capitalize on the industry shift. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And then, you know, just one other thing about the cloud, and this is something that puzzles me when I hear people saying that, when I hear the company saying that the strength is, you know, our future is in the cloud, but the cloud is a very competitive business.
Well, and everybody's jumping into the cloud now too. It's not just IBM. You know, you have all these other software suppliers. They're all into the cloud now.
Yeah, like, well, Amazon and
just look at Adobe. You know, I mean, for the business that I'm in now, you know, production, everybody's into the cloud. Music production,
yeah,
video production.
Yep. Dylan, if they had invested that $158 billion, they would have, I mean, what's the worry about the cloud security? How fast can I get things processed? How can I manipulate the data when it comes in? They would have a way of not being, they would have invested to not be just competing against an Amazon commodity or a Microsoft commodity. They would have the development of a product that so outdistanced the competition that they could demand a premium for it. And that's always been IBM's strength historically over the last 100 years. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't get those years back. You can't get the $158 billion back because you gave that away to Wall Street. That is money that, you know, it will take many years to earn that back through your other lines of business. So it's just gone.
Well, and Bob, to go back to the Watson Jr. era, if they wanted the cash to invest, do you think that IBM could go out and sell stock for $158 billion worth of cash tomorrow?
I doubt Wall Street
would invest in them, right? I mean, to me, that's the question, right? I mean, do shareholders have enough confidence in IBM's CEO and board of directors that if they said, we're going to invest in the cloud and I'm going to spend 10 times, which would be $120 billion, right, to gamble on the cloud, would they invest that in IBM? I think the answer to that is no. And that gets to the heart of the problem, is that paper is only worth what you have, the individual has the trust and confidence in to pay for it. And right now what we're seeing is a lack of trust and confidence in the IBM stock and its leadership. Is that Phil or Bobby, want to chime in, or do you want to wrap here and I'll go into just kind of putting the final touches on this?
Yeah, I think we've got 10 minutes left, so I think it's probably timely to go to the final touches. You know, where do you see the company going, and any other closing thoughts that you might have?
Okay, great. So let me kind of wrap up what I call the 21st century era, including Gerstner, Palmisano, and Rometty. Gerstner found a cash-poor corporation. They have done nothing if made IBM a cash-rich organization. It is not going to fail tomorrow. It generated $16 billion in free cash flow in 23 that dropped to $12 billion at the end of 2014, but it is still a money machine. It can react. It can act. It's got the money to do something if it decides it's going to do it and go after it. So, you know, people that are doomsday sayers, that's not me. It needs the leadership to take that cash and put it in the right place to reestablish trust. Gerstner found a company that was culturally stable. At the time in the 1980s, 95 out of 100 employees would have recommended IBM to their friends to come to work. In 2010, when I left, barely 1 out of 2 would have recommended IBM Corporation to their friends. This has been further documented by Glassdoor recently in their latest surveys. To that, a lot of people say, hey, you know, all the companies are that way. It's just what happens. The industry standard in 1986 was 9 out of 10, and IBM set the standard. The industry standard today is still 9 out of 10, and IBM is not setting the standard. It's middle of the pack. Shareholders were not happy when Lou Gerstner took over. I think they've been fooled into thinking that they should be happy. If you look at the return during Gerstner's era, it was stellar. But one of the things when people compliment Gerstner for turning the company around is they forget that Gerstner took over at the very worst moment in the stock market and rode IBM through the greatest stock market bull run in history. IBM was not only raised by his leadership, but it was raised by the internet. It was raised by the whole direction of the IT industry. And when one looks at investing in IBM stock, you need to compare it with the whole IT industry of the day and then evaluate Lou Gerstner on that. He did save the company from a cash perspective. Culturally, he left it devastated, and it's been continued through Palmisetti and Rometty, Palmisano and Rometty, and that's where we're at today. Where does IBM go? Like I said, it's cash rich. It's not going out of business tomorrow. But it needs, again, a CEO and a board of directors that stands up like Lou Gerstner did when he took over the company and says the customer has to come first. That was what Watson Sr. did when he took over the corporation and said, we've got to fix our products. We have to have products that have higher value than our competition. We need to be able to beat the competition hands down. This isn't also about just technology and products. It's about your employees. IBM has to start investing back in its culture, and that doesn't take a lot of money. It takes time. It takes words. It could be as simple as empowering product managers to show up overnight in front of a customer that's having a product problem. ability of first-line managers to control salaries of their employees again, a reversing a 401k decision that Rometty made, would do, go a long way to allowing employees to see themselves as employee owners. And the shareholders, you know, they are on the edge of their seats right now wondering what's going to happen. They're seeing the free cash flow. If you look at the shareholder value, IBM is now negative, which, you know, and it's not just a little bit negative, it's significantly negative. That's in one of my articles on Seeking Alpha. But normally people buy stock and say, well, at least if it goes under, I get something back. You will get zero back if IBM goes under, and that's a risk. To put that fairly, IT organizations and IT companies tend to have that type of a situation, but IBM is a little bit off the curve there. And I'd have to go, you know, point you to my article to give you the details on that. And then finally, society. We need to get back to a point where IBM talks about being a member of the society within it, within which it operates. So that mutualistic environment where customers and employees are working together to deliver the best products, the best service and support, where shareholders have a long-term perspective of not just this quarter, but of a business that they're going to invest in for the long term. And that's going to take a strong CEO. It's going to take a strong board of directors. Bob, as you put it, standing up against Wall Street and saying, we want to see a company that can deliver long-term values to customers, employees, shareholders, and to the society it lives in. And that's not going to be easy. I think it's going to take a change of leadership within the organization and possibly a change in the board of directors. Bob, that was my summary. Hopefully I hit the time on the mark. And
yeah,
if there's any questions.
Yeah, we just have a few minutes left. I think that's a good wrap. In thinking about this subject, I mean, the thing that just keeps constantly hits me in the face is that in the glory years, a company like IBM, you know, really mastered one of the most remarkable technological changes in, you know, human history, by not laying people off, by balancing interests, by, you know, doing all these things that are, you know, responsive to the needs of the larger society, and yet it was very successful and very profitable and, you know, made a lot of money for its shareholders and provided a good living for its employees. And that's kind of how, you know, corporate America in general functioned in the first 30 or 40 years after World War II. And now what you have is, with IBM and many other companies, is that you have much less employment security, much more volatility, much less continuity. I mean, companies blow up with almost no warning on a routine basis these days. And, you know, they leave all of their stakeholders kind of stranded, and yet we're being told that, you know, layoffs and restructurings, that's the way that a modern company has to function, and I don't really buy it. I really don't. I think, you know, something like this, where we discuss one of the icons of American industry, is a very helpful discussion, and maybe I hope that people who listen to it in archive will think about this as they kind of frame their political.
Yep. Now, in fact, one of the articles I'm thinking about writing is IBM wants to be the Seeking Alpha of IT. Because, you know, Seeking Alpha is a new paradigm, right? I write for them as long as it's profitable for me, and they keep me as long as it's profitable for them, and we part ways if we decide otherwise. And that's what IBM wants its employees to be, ultimately. And I don't think that's going to work in an IT industry.
Yeah. Well, Peter, it was a pleasure having you. And Phil, thank you for dropping in on this call. This show will be available in archive, and you can Pete's book is in the show description, and you can find Peter Grulich on Seeking Alpha. And I want to, again, thank you, Pete. I mean, And it was very enjoyable, and maybe in a few months we'll reconnect and see where we are.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Have a great weekend.
You too, Bob. Take care. Bye.